The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 1st, 2017. Happy July and happy holiday. This week I have three guests on the show. Before we begin, I want to caution listeners that our first story is disturbing. I believe it needs to be heard, but it might make you a little squeamish as it did me. My first guest is retired pro racer and animal activist Odessa Gunn. We'll talk a little bit about her career. We'll also talk about Levi's Grand Fondo, which is named for her ex-husband and friend, Levi Leipheimer. After she retired from racing, Odessa decided to do some volunteer work at the Forget-Me-Not Farm in Sonoma County, California, where she hoped to learn some things about taking care of horses. Odessa is an animal lover and found out that she also became attached to the at-risk youth who came to the farm to learn about caring for the animals and eventually learning about growing their own food for the group homes in which they lived. From that, she has become a fierce and mighty advocate for animals. Just back from a trip to China with 10 rescued dogs, Odessa will tell us about the Yulin Dog Festival and why it is so important to bring it to an end. Once again, please remember that this might make you mighty uncomfortable. We'll take a short break and then head over to Pittsburgh to chat with retired Marine and actually a friend of Brian's and mine, Lloyd Joyce. Many of the stories I'm able to talk about on the show come from people we already know, which just makes doing this work even more fun. By the time you hear this episode, Lloyd will be either on his way to or in Washington, D.C., along with other veterans. Beginning Friday, June 30th, the group left Pittsburgh, traveling to the U.S. Capitol, and they will have ridden 335 miles to complete their fundraising goal of $100,000 to help the Veterans Leadership Program of Western PA. The mission is to, quote, provide essential housing, employment, and vital support services to eligible local veterans, service members, and their families, with the goal of improving their self-sufficiency, sustainability, and quality of life. Finally, we get to meet Kate Dooley. Kate is currently product manager for GT Bicycles, but her journey to get there has often been bumpy and somewhat frightening. This week, journalist Peter Flax wrote an article about Kate in PelotonMagazine.com titled Human Race, Kate Dooley. In it, he documented her journey from carefree rider to cancer survivor. It's a great read if you are interested. So sit back, grab a beer, let's head on out to California and meet Odessa Gunn. Hi, Odessa. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk with you, and we're going to start with you. I want to know a little bit about your background, where you're from, how you got into cycling, and some of your racing career.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Nova Scotia, Canada, which is like south of Newfoundland, and it's one of the Maritime provinces, but it's basically an island in the North Atlantic where it's cold and icy and dark for most of the year. So I didn't start riding a bike until I went to college on the mainland. And then I started to really get into it when I moved to Ottawa, Canada, where there's a lot of cyclists after I graduated from university. And I started because of injuries, because I did a lot of running and I taught aerobics and I dry land coached hockey teams and volleyball teams. And so I have a lot of stress fractures and stuff. And the doctors told me to swim or ride a bike. So I got a bike and I fell in love instantly. Like, it was like love at first ride. And I knew I had to do it.
Wow. Love at first ride. Is this like falling in love with a dog?
Basically, it's like, I mean, I really truly have two loves in my life. And I have been so incredibly lucky because I'm able to do them both. Like, I loved bike riding. Like, I'd never loved anything in my whole life until I met it. You know, I'm so lucky I met bike riding. And then I have this passion for animals. It's like, I've always had it. And it's, I mean, it's number one for sure. It's just in my blood. I have animal blood. So,
you know what? I know what you mean. I'm that same kind of person. So talk a little bit about your racing career in cycling. Was it a long career or a short career? Who did you race for and when did you retire?
Okay. It was pretty short, sadly. The first summer that I got the bike, have a lot of carryover fitness because I just was really fit from all the stuff I was doing. And I made it onto the Canadian National Development Team my first summer. I was training at we have our National Training Center in Calgary, and winter was coming. I decided to go come south to the U.S. So I went to San Diego, and then I rode for Snow Valley and One Plus teams like way back in the day. And then I rode for Shapley, but then I got picked up by Timex, and that's when I became like a pro, and I started doing World Cup races and stuff like that. And this all happened over the course of 4 years. I mean, it was very short because in 2000, I had a really bad crash, and I herniated 6 discs in the back, and I really, truly, I had to retire from it. I couldn't do the training anymore. My back is a lot better now, but at the time, I was just learning how to cope with it, and so... Yeah, I really wanted to make it to the Olympics in 2000 in Australia, but I had a really bad season because of the crash. So that's where it ended. So I retired in 2000. I can't believe it's been so long ago.
Yes, I know. And people say 2000. I'm like, oh, that was 17 years ago. Jeez, where did that time go, right?
I don't know.
I know. So you since have been involved in a lot of interesting things, rewarding projects, most of which involve animals. One of the things I read about you was about this organization, the King Ridge Foundation, which evidently raises funds for at-risk kids, and it comes out of the Forget-Me-Not Farm. So that's kind of the roundabout way of saying, tell me about the Forget-Me-Not Farm, how you got involved, and then how that led to the Fondo.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I love this story. It's so serendipitous. So I found the Forget-Me-Not Farm. I rescued a couple of horses, right? 9 years ago. And I was like, well, I don't know enough about horses to have them. And so a former neighbor said, oh, I read about this Forget-Me-Not Farm. They have a bunch of animals. And so I was like, oh, I'll go out there. So I drove out there wanting to work with farm animals. And we did the orientation, like the volunteer orientation, myself and the two managers of the farm. And they were like, you just have to go get fingerprinted. And I'm like, fingerprinted? I'm like, man, these guys are hardcore. I've never had to get fingerprinted before to work with animals. And then they were like, yeah, because it's the kids. I'm like, what kids? Because I don't have kids. I've never been really like, you know, kids are fine. They're cute and stuff, but I've never wanted them. I think they're great. And so anyway, they were like, yeah, this is a therapy farm for at-risk kids. And I was petrified by that. And they said, you're going to work with the older teenage boys. And I was like, yeah, more petrified by that. And I was like literally sleepless the night before the first time I volunteered because I'm like afraid of teenagers, right? I mean, so I went there and I freaking fell in love. Like, these kids are so amazing and they have got nothing in life. They don't have anybody in their corner. You know, they've just got like, I mean, life is hard enough even when you've been given every opportunity, right?
Right.
It's still a challenge. Yeah. And these kids have no opportunities. And so we're kind of it for them. And so the same year that I started volunteering at the farm, my husband at the time, Levi Leipheimer, he had like a vision on his bike one day. And he's like, I think I need to start a Grand Fondo in Sonoma County. And I think it needs to be for charity. And then boom, we have this crazy event that, like, the second and third and the fourth year, I think we had 7,500 riders.
That's a vision.
Right. And we've raised millions of dollars for charity. Like, luckily, I was like, well, the Forget-Me-Not Farm is, like, it's in our community. It serves, like, at-risk kids. And all of our animals are rescued, and we do rescue projects with the kids. We teach kids compassion, basically, at the farm, and we're part of their therapy program. Like, the state appoints a certain amount of hours for therapy for the kids, which is fantastic. And so it's just the same year I started at the farm, and he got that vision. And so the farm and the event and the foundation have all been growing together. It's just been really amazing. And so the foundation, the King Ridge Foundation, is made to serve at-risk kids in general. So what our beneficiaries now are Social Advocates for Youth. So they're an organization that helps the kids after they age out. So, like, when they turn 18, that's it. The state's like, okay, we're done with you. You're out. Bye. Good luck.
Wow. Let me go back to the Forget-Me-Not Farm for 1 second. So when I was reading about it and looked at it, I could see there were everything from farm animals. You had alpaca, you had llamas, you had horses, all of these things. Did these kids also take care of that? Because I saw you had sort of a farm-to-table program too.
Oh, yeah. We have these huge production gardens. So what we do animal-assisted therapy and horticultural therapy. So we teach the kids, like, how to grow food, where food comes from. A lot of them, you know, the food they eat is kind of institutionalized, right? They're in group homes. All of our kids are in group homes. And so they don't get to kind of pick what they eat. A lot of them don't know where tomatoes come from. They don't know what kale is. And so we literally plant a bunch of food. And over the course of the year, they grow food, and then they take it home to the group homes with them. So they get fresh, organic, amazing, beautiful produce that otherwise would never have access to, you know? And so we do that, and then we teach them, like, animal husbandry, because animals, for some reason, are really disarming, and a lot of these kids have a hard time connecting to other people and communicating with other people, and the animals make that much easier for them. So they're able to cope with certain issues and problems that they have and work through them. So just by working with the animals, and then also we're teaching them compassion, like, at the farm, we respect all living things. Like, there's no killing bugs. You know, we do our best to not harm anything. And we teach them that. And, you know, it's just a respect for life that a lot of them have not been exposed to.
I'm speaking with Odessa Gunn. We've been talking about the work she's doing with At Youth Risk and some of her other advocacy. The Gran Fondo. When is the Gran Fondo this year?
It's September 30th.
Okay.
Gran Fondo. And I'm organizing the festa, which is on the 28th.
We're going to take a real quick break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about another project that Odessa's involved in, one that you may want to just be sitting down to talk about. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Hi, we're back. And as promised, we're going to get back to my conversation with Odessa Gunn. And I'm not sure how to begin talking about this project you're working with to save dogs in China. I guess we should just tell it like it is. Tell us what the Yulin Dog Meat Festival is and why we should be concerned about it.
Okay. Yeah, the Yulin Dog Festival is just a horrific event. It's to celebrate the summer solstice in southern China. And what they do, it's so sick and bizarre. I think, like, a Chinese visionary person announced in 2010, because that's when it started, that if you torture a dog for up to 40 hours before you cook it and eat it, the meat gives you some kind of sexual powers.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, if you're a man, it gives you sexual powers, and then it cools your blood in the hot summer. Just completely ridiculous stuff. So they started this festival. This isn't like an age-old tradition. This is new. And so where they torture the dogs in many, many different ways. Like, they boil them alive, they skin them alive. And if you don't believe me, you can do a really quick Google search and you'll see videos of it happening and people laughing and clapping and videoing it with their phones. They chop their feet off. They do all kinds of horrible, horrible things. And a lot of these dogs are stolen pets. You know, many of them were bred for this. This doesn't make it better in any way. I'm not saying it justifies any of it because I think it's the worst thing in the whole world. Hey, geez. But my dogs agree.
So, of course they do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I learned about this festival has been going on for a while, and I just learned about it the last 3 years. And it's been really bothering me. I've been sending money to charities to help fight it. But this year I was like, I have to do something more because I can't sleep at night knowing it. And I knew it was coming. It starts on June 21st every year. It's past now. And so I knew it was coming, and I just had to do something. And so there's this guy in L.A. His name is Mark Ching. He founded the Animal Hope and Wellness Foundation. He's unbelievable. He's, like, just amazing. He's dreamy. I'm just going to say it. He's dreamy.
Okay.
He's married with kids and everything, but he's just, like, the most wonderful guy. Oh, my goodness. Loves animals, like, more than anything in the whole world. And so he's leading the charge in fighting the UN Dog Meat Festival. And so, being who I am, I was like, all right, I have to meet him and I have to join forces with him. So I did a little bit of, like, stalking. I have a lot of animal rights friends in L.A. And so one of them tipped me off. She's like, he's going to be at, like, this fundraiser event on such and such a date. So I bought tickets to it and I flew down there and then met him. And I was like, listen, what can I do? I want to help you. I want to do something. I want to film it. I want to go over there. I want to just help you. He's like, right on. And he's like, do you want to fly dogs back? And I was like, yep, perfect. So I flew over there, and we filmed a lot of the whole, like, I guess it was a weekend or a few days. We were only there for, like, 48 hours. And then I flew dogs home. And so I raised a whole bunch of money for them beforehand, and I'm still raising money for them. And we're going to go back for more dogs in October. But I had to see some harsh stuff up close. Like, here's what I didn't realize. It's way worse than I thought. Like, I thought that it was just the Yulin Dog Meat Festival that was awful. But as it turns out, like, they have markets, like farmers markets, every single day in China, all over the country, where they have dogs in these horrible, horrible cages. Like, the worst conditions you can think of. In various stages of, like, death, basically, because they haven't had water or food in days and days, and they're just waiting there to be blowtorched. Like, they just blowtorch them.
So I'm trying to wrap my head around the whole idea. Now, I understand that each country has hit its own rituals and its own customs and its own mores and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I know there is outrage for this. What is the government of China saying about this? Why is this okay?
Yeah, I think that, you know, they came out with a statement this year that they made dog meat illegal for a short period of time during the Yulin Dog Meat Festival in that region. But it wasn't real. The police were on the side of the Yulin Dog Meat Festival. The festival went on like it always does. The government did it as like a PR thing. So the good thing is that they're aware that they're getting shamed all over the world and that the world has discussed it with them. Okay, we have big issues here, too. There's big issues all over the world when it comes to animal rights. But at least people in charge in our country make laws that say that animals have to be rendered brain dead before you start dismembering them, right? Like at a slaughterhouse, you have to, like, make the cow brain dead before you start chopping him up. It's called the Humane Slaughter Act, right? And it protects most animals. It doesn't protect poultry, sadly, but I hope that's coming someday. So we're not perfect in this country, but at least everyone agrees that torture is wrong.
Right.
And it's to be avoided. Like, they've got to acknowledge that you can't torture animals intentionally. It's just not, nobody's going to accept that. And it's wrong. And, you know, you can't get away with things anymore in the world because everyone's recording everything. and emailing it all over the place.
That is true. Let me once again remind our listeners, we're speaking with Odessa Gunn. We're going to find out how we can help with this festival and with the Gran Fondo. And so it all kind of ties together. How are you funding your trips to China?
GoFundMe.
Why not?
I know, it's incredible. I've never used it before. And for this trip, I was like, what the heck? Because it costs about $1,000 to bring a dog back. And that includes, like, they have to get, like, all of their shots. And then they have to get, well, they have to be in quarantine for a certain amount of time, like, before or after they get the shots before the flight. And then the crates, the carriers, the airline tickets, all that stuff is expensive, you know? And so it's around about $1,000 a dog. And I raised it all. GoFundMe. I paid my own way, and my friend who came with me, I paid for his ticket and everything. So that was my contribution, and I also sponsored a dog to come back. So
who's working with you on the China side? I know there's a clinic that's working with you and trying to get these dogs ready and helping some of the dogs that you are getting away from the people who are trying to torture and kill them.
Yeah, so that's Mark Ching. So from
okay.
LA, the dreamy guy. So he started Animal Hope and Wellness, and then he met this amazing, amazing, amazing woman, Suki Su, and she has a place in China, and her family donated. They have, like, a farm. Donated their farm to Animal Hope and Wellness, and so it's now a dog rescue, and they have 800 dogs there.
Holy smokes.
I know, and I'm trying to find a cargo airplane to get take like 200 dogs back, but it's not easy. Like I know UPS and FedEx have these cargo planes, right? Because flying these dogs back 10 at a time is going to take forever, and 20 at a time even, it's going to take a long time. And we have to get them out of China because there's no animal protection laws there. And it would be crazy to go through all this effort to rescue them from, like, Mark rescued all of these dogs from being boiled alive and blowtorched and chopped up. Like, they're all rescued from slaughterhouses.
So it is entirely possible that somebody who listens to the show will say, I have a cargo plane.
Wouldn't that be fantastic? And
yes, it would be unbelievably fantastic. And I'm kind of speechless besides being just heartbroken. And I wasn't sure I was even going to get through this interview. So I'm really glad that you approached it the way you did, because it's obvious that while you've seen it all, you've had to sort of, you know, put that aside so that you can do the work you're doing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage. Like, I don't have, there's a spectrum, right? Like, I don't have Mark Ching courage. He goes undercover as a meat buyer and goes into these slaughterhouses and witnesses the way they torture the animals. Like, he has witnessed them cutting eyes out of dogs while it's alive and then chopping its paws off. Like, and then the dog just is screaming. I mean, he's witnessed this stuff, but somebody has to go do that in order to let the world know what's happening. Otherwise, no one knows what's happening. Right?
Yes, of
course. Slaughterhouses have walls, and they get away with this stuff, and you know, you can't... I'm so blown away by him and his courage. So he's got that level of courage where he can do that, but it's destroying him. He's having a really hard time. You know, he suffers with... He comes home, he goes into, like, massive, massive depression, and he just goes dark for a few weeks, and it's really hard on his family, his kids, his wife. I mean, it's tough, right? But he believes this is what he was put here to do, you know, and I'm down the spectrum a little bit where I have enough courage to go over and see the meat markets and see the dogs in the cages. And I actually took a dog. The dog is stolen.
Yeah, I saw that. I went, yeah, good for her. She stole the dog. How cool is that? Shoplifted the dog.
Yes, exactly. I would have taken them all. But I and I stand out there. I'm like 5'10" with white blonde hair. I don't blend in. And so I was like, if anyone's going to get arrested running out of this building with a dog, it's going to be me, you know?
Right. So tell me about the dogs who you brought back, When will they be ready for adoption? Do you have people lined up to adopt? You probably have dozens of people lined up to adopt them.
We do. We have applications, lots of applications for them. They'll be ready. They get spayed and neutered on the 9th. And so they'll be ready like September 11th, you know, really, truly, as quick as they're recovered, they can go home. And I have two of them here at my house who are a little bit more fearful, a little bit shy. And so I just wanted to bring them here to expose them to more things to get them a little bit more socialized.
They seem to be doing better.
They're doing fantastic. Like, I'm so blown away by these dogs. He's, you know, the one that's the most shy, Sunny, he's probably never had human interaction in his whole life. So
right.
The fact that he lets me pick him up and bring him in the house and kiss his face and stuff a lot.
because that's what he does, right? That's what you do, right?
That's what I do. I can't not kiss them. They're just like, oh, dogs. I love them.
Well, you know, I want to get a couple of things out for our listeners. Number one, the GoFundMe site is GoFundMe.com, and it's Saving the Yulin Dogs, Yulin.
Exactly, and, Saving Dogs from Yulin.
Oh, yeah. Saving Dogs for Yulin, from Yulin. And then the other is the Gran Fondo. Now, has the Gran Fondo's name changed? Is there a change in the name of the Gran Fondo?
No, it's Levi's Grand Fondo.
It is still. Okay.
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
And so how is Levi Leipheimer?
He's doing great. We got divorced, it's not quite a year. It'll be a year in October. But we're really lucky because for some reason we had a very, very friendly divorce. We just grew apart. And he's still one of my best friends. I mean, we talk daily. We still have a house together here, a house together in Spain. We're trying to solve both of them. But, yeah, we work together on the event. It's great. It's really, I thank my lucky stars every day because I don't often hear divorce stories like that.
But no, you don't.
Yeah, and he's doing great. He had a bad ski accident this past winter, but he's on his bike again. He's healing. He really kind of shattered his whole leg.
Ugh.
But he's typical Levi. He's like, back on the bike, training is probably like going faster than everybody in the county.
Did you remember that you're not 15 anymore, Levi, really?
Yes. No, he doesn't know that. He never did get that memo.
So the Gran Fondo website is what?
Levi'sGranFondo.com.
Okay. Well, and that comes up this fall. When are you going back to China, or are you?
I'm going to go in October. Yeah. So I wanted to go sooner, but they don't fly dogs back in the summer months because of the heat, because it's dangerous. But I'm going to go back as soon as I can in October. It's our event's over. Yeah.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck. We will keep watching. We will post the information about the GoFundMe campaign, about what you're doing, and about the Fondo. And keep doing all the wonderful good work that you do. I have so much respect for you.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'm really grateful for today. Thank you so much for thinking about me and for having me on. I'm really grateful. It's an honor.
Well, it's my pleasure. Have a great afternoon. Pet those puppies.
You too.
All right.
I will preserve. Thank
okay.
you so much.
All
Bye.
Right. Bye-bye. Odessa Gunn joined me from her home in Sonoma County, California. If you are interested in finding out more about the work she is doing or want to donate to the Rescue Fund, you can log on to GoFundMe.com and click on the Saving Dogs from Yulin link. We're going to take a real short break, and we'll be back to talk with cyclist and marine vet Lloyd Joyce. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back off to Pittsburgh to talk with Lloyd Joyce about the Veterans Leadership Program of Western PA and the ride that they're doing this weekend from Pittsburgh to D.C. Hi, Lloyd. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me, Diane.
Well, it's been a while since we've spoken and we've known each other for a bit. You are a Marine veteran. Is that true?
That is correct. And like they like to say, you know, once a Marine, always a Marine. So there's no ex-Marines.
There are no ex-Marines. That's interesting. I've never actually heard that. So you could just pick right up where you left off, huh?
That's it.
Okay.
That's the thought.
So this week, and, you know, I monitor Facebook. Everybody knows that. you posted a piece about an event in which you're participating this weekend. And when this show airs, you will already have left. It benefits the Veterans Leadership Program of Western PA. Tell me about the organization and what it does for veterans.
So the organization was founded, I believe, in 1982 by Vietnam veterans. And originally it was, I believe it was started to help a lot of the veterans that needed employment help. You know, at that time, Pittsburgh, I think, was losing a lot of jobs and everything. And then it kind of morphed over the years that they, you know, they realized that, hey, there's, veterans could use more help. So what they do is they provide subsidized housing, employment, help, and things of that nature.
Is this for any branch of the service?
Yes, okay. It is. It's for any branch of the service.
So it doesn't have to be just a Marine?
Regular, reserves, anything like that.
Ah, I see. So how are these services funded? Now, your organization, the one with whom you work, is Western PA. So I take it there are other chapters around the country?
To be honest, I think it's more of a local charity that has different branches in this area.
Wow. Do you have any idea of the numbers of people who have been helped since its inception?
I do not. I haven't, like I said, I haven't had a chance to really look into all the numbers more.
Yeah, we can find out. I'll bet we can look online and get those answers. Let's talk a little bit about the ride that's going to go on this weekend. You're going to be participating. I take it you're riding your beautiful bike that we built you?
I am. I'm riding my Waterford and love it. It's working well for me.
Wow, it's a long time. I'll bet we built that bike 10 years ago.
It was after I did a hike in 2000. It was 2010-ish, I believe.
Oh, so 7 years ago. Okay. So tell us about the ride. I know the organization's already raised two-thirds, I guess, of the amount you wanted. 40%. That's what it is. 40% you've raised already.
So what the ride is we're going to be leaving Pittsburgh at 7 a.m. Friday morning. And we'll be on the Great Allegheny Passage, and there'll be 100 riders leaving Friday morning. Of that, there's going to be three rides actually happening. There's going to be a five-day option, which I'll be doing, and then there's a four-day option, and then also a three-day. So you can imagine a three-day people are going to be doing 100-plus miles a day, whereas I'll be doing around 70, 75 miles a day. The VLP has set up rest points, lunch stops, and all that along the way. And then they also have hotels and everything all reserved and ready to go for us.
So are they also taking your gear?
Yes.
Okay.
They'll have a Thursday. They'll have a vehicles set up for each ride to take the necessary gear for everybody.
So this ride will be 355 miles is, I think, what I read.
335.
Oh, 335. And 100 of you are making the trip. How are people donating? Are you raising funds on your own, or are people just knowing about the ride and just, you know, plunking down on the website money?
There's a website called CrowdRise that the VLP is using. And each rider has an account there. And you can link it to your Facebook page, you know, nowadays, Twitter, anything like that. So primarily mine has been done through Facebook. A lot of family and friends have donated that way. And then I also have a few businesses. My local VFW has also donated.
Let me ask you, as a veteran, and from your perspective, do you think that veterans should have to go through these kinds of sort of machinations to raise funds to help one another after they've done what they've done for the U.S.?
No, of course not. You'd think there'd be more things in place, but there aren't. You know, that's the reality. So this is just over and above, you know, whatever other help they can get out there. You know, the VLP, I believe, is really good at, you know, helping with housing. You know, they do employment and, you know, other supportive services, you know, financial assistance and stuff like that.
If you see them helping more recent retirees as opposed to, I know the person who started it was from the Vietnam era, and, you know, moving forward through time from there, are we seeing more younger soldiers being helped than the older soldiers?
My feel, and I just was reading some of their, in their website, you know, the VLP, I think they're saying that homelessness is, you know, 10% of the population, maybe. But they said, like 16% of the veterans are homeless, and usually they're homeless for longer, as a veteran, they're homeless longer than other homeless people. So
it's sad. You know, it makes me sad. And I hate being sad, but at least you guys are doing something. So I'm trying to remember what your bike, what kind of tires are you using on this ride? Because you're going to be on the Allegheny Passage, and from what I understand, you need kind of a, you know, a wider tire.
Yeah, so I kind of had you guys had spec'd out like a hybrid tire that it's not a road tire, but, you know, it's not by any means a mountain bike tire. So it's just a hair more aggressive than your normal road tire that someone would use.
Oh, you have an adventure cycle, huh? You have like a touring machine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was built. My hope is to go cross country someday.
So I have one more really weird question for you. You built yourself a tiny house.
I'm in the process of, yeah.
I've seen it. It's so cute. Are you going to actually like stick that on the back of a truck and ride where, I mean, live in it?
That's my hope. I'd like to initially just plunk it down somewhere close to home, you know, southwestern PA, and do, you know, sort of a trial run for a couple of years. And then I'd like to move somewhere out west, somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, you know, Washington and Oregon, hopefully.
Wow. All right. Well, let's let our listeners know how to find out about the VLP and especially about your 335 miles for veterans, which actually is starting the day before we did this interview. What do you know what the VLP website is?
Yes. So the VLP website is going to be VLPWPA.org. And if you get on the website, right up top there, they have a donate button. So you can donate directly from there.
Okay. Well, I hope you have a lot of fun. It's supposed to be a great ride from Pittsburgh to D.C. Have you done it before?
I have not. It's been on my bucket list. You know, one of those things, I live actually on an offshoot of it. You know, the Montour Trail connects into the Great Allegheny Passage at points. So it's in my backyard.
That's cool. Well, I'm kind of looking at the picture of a group of people who must have finished this ride last year. And you're not in it, so you must be doing it this year. I'll be looking forward to the group ride because I know what
I'm
look like. No, of course not.
It's amazing because it's been meteoric. Last year, I believe they only had 17 riders, and this year, you know, it's 100. So it's going to be a pretty awesome undertaking.
I think so. Well, I hope you have a great time. Stay safe. Raise lots of money. And I like what you're doing. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for having me, Dan.
All right. Take care. Lloyd Joyce joined me from his office in Pittsburgh. If you are interested in helping the VLP reach its fundraising goals, you can log on to crowdrise.com/VLPWPA. We're going to take a break and we'll be back to speak with Kate Dooley. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Are back. We are going to mosey over to the GT offices in the Bay Area of California and speak with rider, product manager, and all-around cool person, Kate Dooley. Hi, Kate. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Diane. I really appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. How is California today?
It is sunny and beautiful, which I know is very shocking.
I can see where this conversation is going to go. That's awesome. Yeah, that's exactly right. California, land of the sunshine. Now, where are you in California? Where is the office?
I work remotely, so I'm based in the Bay Area in California.
Nice. You don't have to be, like, at the office every day? How cool is that?
It's definitely nice. I work East Coast hours, so I am up pretty early to work with my colleagues that are based in the East Coast and also our European office. So still get to see the sunrise. And I basically work the same hours that my coworkers do.
So I want to know a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you got into cycling. And we know that you work for GT right now as a product manager, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Just tell me a little bit about how you grew up and, you know, cycling, where cycling sort of fit in.
Sure. I think I'm one of those few people that never stopped riding bikes as a kid. Bikes were always a part of my life. I grew up in a neighborhood where all the kids would meet up on the street and go ride bikes. We built little tiny dirt jumps. There was a hill down the street where we would try and ride with no hands. So bikes were always a part of my life, and I didn't really put that much thought into it. I got a mountain bike. My parents got me a mountain bike when I was maybe like 11 or 12, and I became obsessed, and I would go ride in the woods that was by my house. And then I got older, and I ended up fixing up a bike to get around when I was in school, and that's how I got around Boston and pretty much anywhere as an adult.
Do you own a car now?
I do own a car now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking. I mean, it's hard to live in California and not have a car, I guess.
Oh, yeah, it's very true. And actually, I had a car in Boston, too, but I only really had it so I could go race bikes.
Put the bike in the car and go
somewhere.
I got it. So earlier this week, Peter Flax, who I speak with quite often on the show, and he writes some awesome articles, wrote an article about you. He told your story, how it unfolded, and some of which is, you know, fairly painful to read. Can you tell us a little bit, if you're willing, about your journey from being this healthy racer to being ill and then back to a healthy racer who is living her dream in the bike industry?
Yeah, I could definitely tell you about that. Like I mentioned before, I was a bike racer. The year that I got diagnosed, which was in 2012, I started getting really serious about bike racing. Like, oh, I'm really going to train. I'm going to get a coach. So I was doing all of that, and I started racing road on a road team, which wasn't normal for me because I mostly race cyclocross. And so I had been feeling overtrained, but I was like, oh, you know, maybe it's just a lot of training load and just some other small, random, weird symptoms. But individually, it didn't really seem to add up to anything to me. And I had been racing a crit, and I had to drop out because I was getting these weird numb sensations in my limbs, and my tongue got all fuzzy, and I just felt something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. So I dropped out, had a friend drive me home, and that's when I called my dad, who was a nurse, and he knew that something was wrong, but obviously didn't want to freak me out, so he played it pretty cool. Later, he would tell me he was freaked out. And I went to the ER, and they did some tests, and they didn't find anything conclusive. And then for the next several months, it was more tests. I had a couple MRIs, lots of blood work, and they had been looking for basically compressed nerves. So they ended up finding, instead of a compressed nerve, a tumor about the size of a golf ball in my neck, which I was not expecting. I was 24 at the time, and being sick or not super healthy had never occurred to me. But they were like, oh, you know, it's probably nothing, just a growth. We have to still biopsy it, you know, just to do our due diligence. And I got the results back, and it was, in fact, cancer. And we scheduled surgery for 2 weeks from when I got the call. And a lot of people were like, oh, okay, thyroid cancer, that's going to be, you know, I hear I've had a friend who's had that, or, you know, the recovery will be pretty good. But it actually hit me quite hard. Managing thyroid levels, especially as an athlete, is pretty difficult. And also the treatment that you have to go through can be pretty miserable. You don't do chemo or anything like that, but you do have to manipulate your hormone levels and take on some radioactive radiation to ablate the rest of the cancer cells. And once all that had been through and I'd been declared cancer-free, that was actually when the really hard stuff started to happen, because I would get tested for my thyroid levels, and I just didn't really feel right. And as an athlete, someone who had just been focused on fitness my whole life one way or the other, I was too tired to do anything. And I, you know, now I was 25, 26, just like looking at all my friends and like, why don't I feel like them? I want to be doing all the things that I used to do, but I literally just can't, no matter how compliant I am with when I'm supposed to take my thyroid medication and all that. And I finally found a doctor who really listened to me, and we straightened out a whole bunch of things. And it took about a year to straighten everything out. And now I think I feel what is normal or healthy. It's been quite some time now, so I'm not sure. But I feel great. So
wow,
that is probably the shortest version I can come up with on that. But it was a real struggle for a couple of years for me, because I would feel better, and then I would like dig myself into a huge hole that I just couldn't recover. That was the big thing, that I could do something, and then it would take me 2 weeks to recover from something that would take me 2 days, you know.
If you could sort of synopsize what it was this other doctor did to get you back on track, was it nutrition? Was it medication? Was it a combination of things?
It was a combination of things. So I had a few things going on. Hypothyroid patients tend to also have like some GI issues and absorption issues. So I had really low vitamin D and low iron, which is very, very common. So that was one thing, managing that. And the other thing is the medication that I was given, and just the ranges, because there are different blood tests you can take for thyroid hormones, and there's the acceptable range. But for each person, that's different. So even if a patient falls within the clinical okay zone, that doesn't mean that they necessarily feel good at that stage. So having a doctor that actually listened to me when I said, okay, yeah, I get that my thyroid stimulating hormone level is in the normal range, but I still feel like garbage, and being willing to try different medications and different dosages, because it's, every time you change dose, it takes 6 to 8 weeks until that dosage actually kicks in. So it's actually a process to figure out whether or not you move the needle in the right direction.
Wow. Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Kate Dooley. She is a product manager for GT. She races a bike. I don't know if you're still racing a bike, but she did race a bike. She's a cancer survivor, and she's kind of full of it. Here's something I just learned about you. You're an animal lover.
I am an animal lover.
Do you know who else is on the show with you this week?
I do not.
Odessa Gunn.
Oh.
Do you know Odessa?
I do know. Oh, I don't know her, but
yes.
I've heard of.
Speaking of animal rights people, right? She's the one who's rescuing all the dogs from China. So since your recovery, I want to back up a second. I read something about you do something crazy big once a year, and that you didn't like airplanes. You don't like airplanes. You decided to jump out of one. Now, I do not have those kind of nerves. But then the next day you went into your job and you quit. What happened?
Yeah. So a little bit more about me. Any of my friends or close family will tell you that I am not an impulsive person. I'm very analytical. I like to take my time making decisions, weigh everything out. So this in particular is very out of character for me. I like to have a plan. I like to know how things are going to go. And despite any and all reason, I decided that I needed to go skydiving because it scared me. And so I went and did that. And I don't know if you've ever been skydiving before. But
no, I don't jump out of perfectly good airplanes. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's irrational, which I completely recognize. But for whatever reason, I felt that I needed to do this. But you're in the sky for quite some time. And so there's a few seconds when you're in total free fall. And, you know, when you're skydiving for the first time, you're doing tandem skydiving, or I think that's what it's called. So the other person's operating it. You're just, like, hanging on, being like, cool, I'm strapped to you. You have a few moments of free fall before the parachute starts going, and then you're in the sky for a while. And you're just like, okay, well, I super hope that this goes well. But if it doesn't, I'm okay with that. You have to just, at least me, I tried to mentally prepare myself for, like, being okay with the outcome, no matter what it was. And I just realized that I was doing something that wasn't making me happy, and that there was no reason for it, other than I felt like it was what I should be doing. And I had been kind of thinking about quitting that job for a while, but, again, I'm a person that likes to take my time making decisions, so I hadn't done it yet. So, yeah, I went skydiving that weekend, then I went into work, and I gave my 2 weeks' notice, and that's when I decided, you know what, I'm just going to take this fall off, race some bikes, figure out what I'm going to do. I'm not going to worry about that because I've got plenty of savings in my bank account, and I'll figure it out and go in the direction that I need to go.
And so you ended up where you wanted to be because somewhere along the line you said, I'm still going to make my living in the bike industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you work at GT. You are a product manager. And I kind of has, I didn't realize you are the women's product manager. Is that correct?
Yeah. I do all of our inline, road, trekking, urban, e-bike, and I do women's product as well.
Okay. So this is going to sound like one of those. It's not really a sexist question, having been in the bike industry for 43 years as a retailer. But do you really think we need a women's section? Just really. I'd like to hear.
So here's what I think. As a product manager and as a women's product manager, what we do with women's products, we don't give you a different geometry or lower spec or anything like that. Spec for spec, the bikes are the same. That's for a number of reasons. The most important one to me being that I believe that any person, any gender, wants to ride the same awesome stuff that is inline or not women's product or whatever you'd like to call it. I think women's products in general, you see women's shoes, men's shoes, women's running shorts, men's running shorts. That's how things are merchandised in retail. And I
That's
think,
true.
I think it's super tough with bikes because I feel like there's a place for both, that people should buy whatever they want. But I think in particular, and whether it's right or wrong, the bike industry was trying to look for a way and is still trying to look for a way to bring women in. And I think for a lot of people who are not familiar with the sport, no matter where you are, man or woman, or however you identify, when you walk into somewhere, you're looking for a sense of belonging. So even if there's only a few products for women, I think that signals to people who might be nervous that, oh, maybe I don't belong here and I should just walk out of the store, that at least someone has put some thought into it. When it was the pink it and shrink it age, that definitely sent the wrong message. But I think looking across the industry now, you're not seeing that. So I think there is a place for women's products. I don't think women need to ride women's bikes. I think they're a great option.
Well, I think it's an excellent answer. I think it's a really well thought out answer, and it makes a lot of sense. So obviously women's shapes are different. Shorts and shoes do need to be different. I was specifically looking at hardware, and you answered the question extremely well, and I appreciate you doing it, having been on the other side of the counter where you are manufacturing and I was the retailer. So I totally get it, and I appreciate that. Thanks.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's super tough. I think I don't know if it's necessary, but I think having that there, having different styles of product available for people, forced everyone to think about it a little bit more. Like, oh yeah, maybe the pink and shrink idea is not a great idea because it's kind of pandering to people, and people don't want that at all in general. So.
And then there was the other end of the spectrum where they were, where there are a lot of sexist kind of ads that people get in, get their panties in a bunch about. So there's a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I don't think our industry is any different from a lot of the other sporting goods industries. But, it's nice to think that maybe we might be ahead of the game on something.
Yeah.
So sure. Let me ask you a question about your favorite bike. So you actually have a couple of bikes from Boston. Actually, you have three as far as I can tell. I'm not sure if I know if
You're
I'm
good.
Right.
You're good.
Yeah,
okay,
you have two Geek House and one Firefly.
Yes.
I just spoke with Tyler Evans 2 weeks ago, so I know all about the Firefly. I don't know anything about Geek House. Tell me about the bikes. Are they cool? Obviously, you have two of them.
Yeah, so Geek House is near and dear to my heart. They're actually the first team that I ever raced for, and Geek House is run by Marty Walsh, who's been building for about a decade now. I was actually one of my closest friends. But I started racing on the Geek House Cyclocross team in, 2009 or 10. And he built me that bike. It's been repainted now. So now originally it was blue and pink. But for my birthday a couple years ago, he and Brad, who used to work there, Brad now works at 7, had a friend do a custom paint job on it. So it's got a really awesome, orangey green fade and splatter on it.
Nice.
And then I have a second team cross racing bike. They're both Mudville models. And I got that one a couple years later, and it's got some updated tubing, some updated true temper tubing. And those two, all three of those bikes are really special to me.
I'm sure they are. They're all wonderful bikes. Now, are they all steel or tie or a combination?
So the Geekhouse bikes are steel.
Uh-huh.
And the Firefly No Shock is a tie bike.
Right. Okay.
The other thing is I actually used to work for Geekhouse for a little bit, too. So I actually worked at the shop.
Oh, okay. Well, that certainly makes some sense. So I won't ask you which is your favorite bike. That isn't a fair comparison anymore because you use them for different things, I'm sure.
I couldn't choose.
Exactly. So we briefly touched on the fact that you do one big thing every year. What are you going to do this year? Do you have it in mind already?
Well, so I thought I had one in mind, but due to a conflict, I had to cancel it. So I'm trying to come up with something else. But what I'm thinking right now is I think I am looking at doing like a trail marathon or ultra marathon this fall. I haven't picked one yet. No, it's not bike related. But last year, I did Trans-BC, and I did a trail half. This year, I was going to do another mountain bike stage race, but it just didn't work out. So I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'll just go big on the running and see how that goes.
Yeah, that's cool. So I always ask my guests three questions, and I'm going to ask you these three questions. What's your favorite food?
Tough. What is my favorite food? I would have to say that my favorite food, it's got to be like carrots and hummus.
Interesting. A healthy food.
Nice. No, very boring to me.
No, it's not boring. No, let me tell you, after 37 people say pizza, hummus and carrots doesn't sound so bad. You know, bike guys, pizza and beer, right? So what kind of music do you listen to?
I listen to all kinds of things. I like hardcore music and punk and electronica. I like some rock and roll. I listen to a little bit of everything, which I feel like everyone says. But the one weird thing that I will say about music is that at work, if I'm concentrating on spreadsheets, I will just listen to the same song all day. Not because I'm really listening to it, but so other noise does not distract me.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of like it's on an endless loop.
Yeah, and then I just don't really have a concept of time anymore, so I just keep working. Like, oh, yeah, we're in the middle of the song again. I don't know how many times to listen to it.
All right, well, I know you're an animal lover, so I guess this is kind of a moot question. Do you have any pets?
Don't. Weird or not, I don't.
Wow.
It's just me. But my parents have a dog who I love dearly. He's a rescue. His name's Murphy. He's very adorable. But I grew up with dogs, so In that sense, I do have a pet, but I currently travel so much that it would be really unfair to whatever pet I might have to leave from our home all the time.
Yeah, I did see that you're traveling a lot of weeks a year. Well, it's been a really fun time talking with you, and I really appreciate it. I'm glad you are healthy. I'm glad you found the work that you love to do. And if you're at the Builders Ball, come see me. I think our booth number is 33. I have no idea why I know that, but I do. And we could have a little chat there.
Yeah, if I'm not that way, I'll definitely swing by and say hello.
All right. Well, thanks for talking with me today.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Kate Dooley joined me from her office at GT. What a delightful young woman. That's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Kate, of course, and Odessa Gunn for a great conversation and for the brave and, I believe, important work that she is doing. I also would like to thank Lloyd Joyce and hope the ride to D.C. goes well. He says it might rain. We'll see. And stay safe over the 4th of July holiday. Remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.